This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, Family Security Committee will come to order. There is a quorum present. We're going to start with Senator Kubley. Senator Kubley, I think we'll start with Senate File 330, if that's okay. That's your Minnesota Care supplemental coverage.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 330, there is a small amendment that makes some technical changes to bring the bill up to date.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that amendment
for... Is it in the packets? It's not in the packets. We'll pass it out, and then we'll vote on Senator Coring's motion. So we will start talking about the bill as if it's...
Okay, we can do that, Mr. Chair. This bill was brought to me last year by the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance that operates in our part of the state. And with me on my left is Greg Thorson, and he'll talk to the committee about the bill and the need that is seen for it.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Marty and members of the committee. Again, my name is Greg Thorson. I am the research coordinator for the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. I'm joined here today by Darlene Nichols-Bourne, one of our board members that represents Big Stone County in our organization. The West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance is composed of members from 12 counties in West Central Minnesota, essentially runs from the region of Traverse County to the northwest, Douglas County to the northeast, Yellow Medicine County to the southwest, and Renville County to the southeast. So to include the cities such as Wilmer, Alexandria, and Montevideo for an area. Our group is committed to learning more about the everyday health insurance needs of the residents of our part of the state. And we're interested in partnering not only with government, but also with business and insurance leaders to help improve the quality and affordability of healthcare insurance products available in our region. So we've held numerous public forums in West Central Minnesota. In fact, we have three coming up this week in Alexandria, Montevideo, and Wilmer. We've administered hundreds of scientifically sampled surveys to find out what's going on in our region, both from the residents of our region, small businesses, and healthcare providers. And so we're here today to talk a little bit about one of the concerns that we have that Senator Kubley has developed a bill to address, and that would be the $10,000 inpatient hospitalization cap that's found in Minnesota Care. We would add, though, that although we've talked and been a lot of dialogue with residents of West Central Minnesota, we don't really see ourselves as being particularly unique in this regard, that we think the concerns in West Central Minnesota are very similar to those in the rest of the state of Minnesota. Residents of Minnesota are looking for quality, affordable health care products, regardless of where they live. So we've been operating as a purchasing alliance since 2003. We're registered with the Minnesota Department of Health. Our funding comes exclusively from nonprofit organizations such as the Otto Bremer Foundation, the West Central Regional Sustainable Development Partnership, the Southwest Minnesota Foundation, et cetera. I'm actually a Central Minnesota boy. I was raised in Princeton, Minnesota, about 15 miles north of here. Graduated from Princeton High School. Went to Augsburg College, where I got my bachelor's degree, and got my master's and PhD in political science from the University of California at Riverside. Most recently, I served as a professor in the political science department at the University of Minnesota at Morris campus. So our West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance then strongly supports the Senator Kubley's bill, Senate File 330. And again, this bill addresses what is a significant problem in Minnesota care, that it caps inpatient hospitalization coverage at just $10,000. In the testimony that you should have in front of you, I did put together Table 1, which is found on page 5 and 6, that lists the mean inpatient hospitalization charges for people who are admitted to Minnesota hospitals. So this is 2007 data, mean inpatient hospitalization data. And you can see there that it is not uncommon at all for charges in Minnesota hospitals to vastly exceed $10,000, the cap that's currently provided by Minnesota Care. So, for example, leukemia, the typical mean inpatient hospitalization charges for a leukemia patient that's admitted to Minnesota hospitals is in excess of $140,000. In other words, if this patient would be admitted as a Minnesota Care patient, they'd have $10,000 of coverage, and the remaining over $130,000 they're personally liable for. Other charges that stand out, for example, that you can see that a spinal cord injury is over $107,000. You have a heart valve problem, over $89,000. Aneurysms, over $73,000. You get hit by one of those legendary Minnesota mosquitoes and unlucky enough to hit get encephalitis, over $66,000. Cardiac arrest, again, over $66,000. In other words, it's not at all uncommon for people to experience hospitalization charges that exceed the $10,000 inpatient hospitalization cap in Minnesota Care. So what happens if a Minnesota Care enrollee has an adverse health event? They only have $10,000 in coverage. What will happen to the rest of that? Well, very few Minnesotans can afford to take on that debt personally. And, of course, they will be responsible for that debt personally, especially Minnesota Care enrollees. Very few of them can handle debts of that size. And so not surprisingly, I think we're seeing in Minnesota what we're seeing nationally, that more and more of these turn into the bankruptcies that we see in the country. That last June's article in the American Journal of Medicine demonstrated that over 62% of our bankruptcies in the United States, 62%, are now caused by medical bankruptcies. So that creates enormous problems for people and their families in Minnesota Care when these types of adverse health events occur. And so we see that that's playing out a lot. The average out-of-pocket cost for people who have medical bankruptcies is about $18,000. Okay, so that's a little bit of data. So not only does this devastate the people and their families who have these adverse health consequences that are forced into bankruptcy, they lose many of their assets perhaps, but then also that serves up as uncompensated care for our healthcare providers. The devastation doesn't end with the person and their family. It moves on to the healthcare providers. And in our region, we've done a lot of survey work on this data, and it suggests that they're already in a precarious place financially. They're dealing with low reimbursement rates from insurers and an incredibly competitive marketplace that way for reimbursements, as well as low government reimbursement rates. So this concern over Minnesota Care and its inpatient hospitalization cap is something that's raised frequently at our public forums. The public response is usually fairly surprised and then alarmed and then transforms to outrage. What people are wondering is, as much as they love Minnesota Care, that it covers their routine visits to the doctor and has a nice benefit set that they very much appreciate, they can't understand why it would cover routine visits to the doctor but not catastrophic events like heart attacks, strokes, and cancer. They don't understand why they would have one of the state's premier healthcare programs and not have coverage for the catastrophic events that insurance is intended to protect us against. So worse yet, they learn that the law itself, Minnesota law, prohibits them from covering their risk. They not only have this $10,000 inpatient hospitalization cap, but they can't buy a supplemental policy that would allow them for coverage should their hospital bills be in excess of $10,000. So as a result, then, we are strongly in favor of Senator Kubley's bill. We think it's a reasonable solution. It's not our optimal solution either. We wish that the inpatient hospitalization cap was eliminated from Minnesota Care. But it's simply not fiscally or politically possible right now. But we have to do something for our residents so that they're not exposed to this kind of risk being Minnesota Care patients. We also are very understanding of the state's financial condition. We've watched you struggle with trying to provide for our neediest residents through the GAMC program and how difficult that has been, and we strongly support efforts to continue that program. But nevertheless, the result is then we understand that we can't do something that involves a significant amount of resources from the state. So we think that Senator Kubley's bill that allows individuals to have supplemental coverage is a very reasonable one, given both the fiscal and political constraints we offer. It's in the House, it's gotten a lot of bipartisan support. Both the top DFLers and the top Republicans on both policy and finance committees of the health bills in the House are both serve as co-authors for the bill. The co-authors for the bill include Representative Thiessen, Representative Murphy, Representative Huntley are all co-authors on this bill, as well as Representative Abler, Representative Keenan, Representative Hornstein, Representative Anzelk, Representative Murrow. They're all co-authors on the companion bill in the House of Senator Kubley's the bill we're discussing today. So the bill easily passed out of the House Healthcare and Human Services Policy and Oversight Committee. And so now we think it has an excellent chance of being included in the final omnibus health care bill. But as you know, it first must get past your committee by Friday for it to be considered for inclusion and for it to advance further. So we wanted to express our support today for Senator Kubley's bill, Senate Finance File 330. And Senator Marty, I want to thank you for allowing me to participate today in your hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Thorson. Senator Coring moved the A1 amendment. A technical author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Questions for Mr. Thorson? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Thorson, what is the premium cost for the supplemental insurance that you're proposing be made available? What would be that cost?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's an excellent question because right now such a policy doesn't exist. Okay? That we have similar policies that have $10,000 deductibles, but they're more fully featured products. This policy would be very narrow. It would just focus on inpatient hospitalization caps in excess of $10,000. We've talked with a variety of insurance agents in our region to get estimates of what that would cost. And the current thoughts are that it would vary, but again, the only variance allowed is by the age of the recipient. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 to $100 a month is what we've heard a lot of. But we don't have this policy doesn't yet exist. If this group moves forward, it will be allowed to exist and could be developed in the marketplace.
And, Mr. Chairman, thank you. What is the premium cost for Minnesota Care?
Yeah, and Minnesota Care is based on a sliding scale based on an individual's income. And so it varies based on the income of the recipient.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Thorson, I'm familiar with that, and I believe the low end is about $4 a month.
That's correct.
So, and as I understand it, Minnesota Care was designed for low-income folks, and so that's one of the reasons for the sliding scale. So if a person was paying $4 a month, how would they possibly be able to afford a $100, $150 a month supplementary insurance plan?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I am in total agreement with you. This is not the best way to do this. This should be covered within Minnesota Care. And so it will work disproportionately against the low end who are going to, this does not involve public subsidies to support this private supplemental plan. And we have the very same and share those concerns about the low end of the income being able to afford the supplement. But we don't see a lot of other options given the fiscal climate that we're in.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Thorson, I've been working with Representative Gottwald in the House on a couple of different bills to get at this very problem you're talking about. We've had bills that would extend the coverage of Minnesota Care plans up to $5 million, for example. They're modeled on some high deductible structures, but having the initial amounts be paid for by public subsidy. We've not been able to get hearings on those bills. Why? It seems to me that if we're going to reform this, we ought to reform it. I'm just concerned that if this idea is to do something for folks that are on Minnesota Care, I'm not sure that what you're proposing would work if the people who are on Minnesota Care can barely afford the premiums that are already reduced for Minnesota Care.
Mr. Chair, Senator, and I think there are a large number of people that would not be able to afford the supplement. And we regret that. But there are a significant number that would. And we've heard from them in our public forums that they wish that they had the opportunity to purchase that supplemental plan. Again, we don't think it's the perfect solution. But how long are we going to allow our residents to be exposed to this risk? Are we going to wait for the budget climate to get rosier? Are we going to wait for the political climate to be more advantageous to expand Minnesota Care in this fashion? We came here several years ago trying to eliminate the inpatient hospitalization cap. At a time when the Minnesota Care, the Healthcare Access Fund, was being taken for non-healthcare purposes, when there was funding within the Minnesota Healthcare Fund to do exactly what we're asking for now, but because of budget deficits relating from the general fund, we were unable to get to advance that request. So I think it's Senator Kubley's bill is politically, pragmatic and it's fiscally pragmatic given the constraints that we have now.
And Mr. Chairman, just one last comment. Mr. Thorson, it would seem to me that if a person was in a position to afford the supplemental policy, they may not be eligible for Minnesota Care. It would seem that they could purchase a regular insurance policy that would give them more coverage. But I just, you know, and absent any detail about the premiums and the structures, I know personally I am familiar with insurance plans that are provide great coverage that are not that expensive. But I guess it's hard for me to make a judgment on this, not seeing any real data about what we're looking at in terms of costs and how this would work.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hahn. I know from visiting with some of the hospitals in my district that a majority of the people on their uncompensated care list are also on Minnesota Care. You know, so they feel that this would be helpful in at least diminishing the losses that they receive from their uncompensated care list by even if a person only, you know, bought a policy that would cover the next 10 or 15,000, which would be relatively a relatively small premium on a monthly basis, but it would also give hospitals a chance to recoup, you know, a portion of that loss that is currently uncollectible.
Senator Prittner-Solin and Senator Brugman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thorson, when somebody reaches their cap, who's responsible for the amount over the cap?
Yes, Senator Marty. They're personally liable for that remaining amount. When they signed in to get their emergency care or their hospitalization care, they claim that any amounts not covered by their insurance policies they'd be personally liable for.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify the version the witness gave you of lifting the hospital cap in Minnesota Care. That was passed by the division. I think was supported on a bipartisan basis. We took it to conference committee, and we were told that the governor would not sign the bill if it stayed in the bill. It wasn't that we couldn't afford to do it at that time. We could, and it was a priority to try to raise it. It hasn't been raised since the program was originally created, but we couldn't get it to happen because the governor wouldn't sign the bill then.
Thank you. Further, Ms. Nichols-Bourne, go ahead. Is that your name? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. You would just answer questions?
I just would answer any questions, yes.
Is there further discussion of this? I have a motion.
I'll move the bill be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Bourbon moves that Senate File 330, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Mr. Thorson, Ms. Nichols-Bourne, I think you got a wonderful program. I wish you the best in that. And I can see how this will help fill a major gap out there. But yeah.
Thank you.
So on Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Kubley, we might as well take up your second one now. Senate File 1233. And there is a delete everything amendment that you wanted offered?
There is, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dowell moves the delete everything amendment for the author. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That prevailed on pretty close to a 0-0 vote, but the chair voted out.
I voted for it.
Good.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, this bill, Senate File 1233, has been worked on by the massage therapists and their organizations for quite a period of time now. I originally asked them if they'd been working on it longer than I'd been here. This is my 14th year. They said no, not quite that long, but it was pretty close. But I do think that they've come a long way. There are still a couple of groups that would like to have been included, and I'm certainly not opposed to those groups having their process as well, and yet we had an objection from the Board of Nursing that feels that the groups who are still opposed are, you know, to include them in this bill would mislead members of the public in terms of what they felt was available should they go to a person who was certified under this bill. So, you know, they did indicate, you know, I think Shirley Brecken, who's the executive director of the Board of Nursing, did indicate that she was more than willing to work with them to to work out an amendment that would cover them. And I guess, you know, I think that that would be a good idea, and I'd certainly be willing to try and work with them as well. I know they're disappointed, but hopefully we can move ahead with this bill this year, Mr. Chair, and we can take care of the groups that would like to be included in the future. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Jeremy Miller, who is a member of one of those therapy groups, to talk to you about why it is that his organization would like to see the bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Miller. I've been a massage therapist since 1997. I work at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in the Department of Integrated Medicine, and I'm here today in the capacity of Government Relations Chair for the American Massage Therapy Association's Minnesota chapter, and I'm also the chair of the grassroots group, the Alliance for Licensing Massage Therapists. Our alliance represents several hundred massage therapy professionals, clients, employers, and other healthcare professionals who support massage therapy regulation to protect Minnesota's public. We come before you having conducted 17 town hall meetings all over Minnesota, launched a website, and spent many months working, meeting with almost two dozen trade associations, and underwent a very rigorous review by the Minnesota Council of Health Boards. Senate File 1233 is the product of all these efforts of all these folks for many years. Massage therapy is an allied healthcare profession and is regulated as such in 43 states and the District of Columbia. The clinical benefits of massage therapy are being published in peer-reviewed medical journals, and those benefits are observable regardless of the setting in which the massage is received. Massage therapy is the only health field in Minnesota regulated at the municipal level. These local licensing ordinances cut access to care for clients by being overly burdensome in cost or in scope of regulation, or in some cases both, and have no city-to-city reciprocity. Massage therapists, for example, who cannot afford to pay Wyzetta's $8,325 fee in addition to Brooklyn Center's $3,500 fee, either refuse to go to clients in those cities or they practice illegally. Under this bill, access to care for clients will dramatically be opened up, as these massage therapists who voluntarily register would be exempted from these city ordinances. This bill would remove a massive and onerous burden from the backs of small business owners in Minnesota. As a small business owner myself in West Virginia, I saw the positive difference being state credentialed can make. I started my business prior to the passage of West Virginia's licensing law, and I continued to practice there after the law took effect, and the effects could not have been more stark. The difference in the way my practice was viewed by referring providers, business partners, as well as other, and most importantly, potential clients, was like night and day. In the 43 states with massage credentialing, complaints per 1,000 practitioners, which is the way Minnesota makes a ratio of that, last year ran as high as 28 complaints per 1,000 massage therapists. Now, that number is higher than the reported ratio from Minnesota's last biennial report for nurses, physical therapists, and social workers combined. There is a clear need to protect the public, and this was verified in the Minnesota Council of Health Board's most recent report on massage therapy. This very extensive review process by a panel of not just Minnesota healthcare providers, but Minnesota healthcare regulators found the following. Massage therapy is used as a healthcare service. In regard to this occupation, Minnesota is lagging behind other states in regulating this profession. The overall compelling state interest in the regulation of massage therapy is the protection of public safety. Public health consequences of incompetent, improperly trained, or unethical practitioners include significant public harm. And finally, in the case of massage therapy, where a practitioner may or may not work in a number of venues and may or may not be supervised, regulation offers consumers a level of protection that does not otherwise exist. The Pew Health Professions Commission 1995 report on healthcare regulation used massage therapy as an example of a profession for which voluntary title protection regulation is appropriate, the bill that you have before you today, as it offers public protection by giving clients the choice of a practitioner who has been vetted by standard state qualifying criteria. Senate File 1233, as amended, is a straightforward voluntary title protection act aimed at protecting the public. It is modeled after massage therapy regulations nationwide, as well as other Minnesota health care provider statutes. Just to quickly walk through the bill, sections 3 and 4 delineate standards of what a registered massage therapist may and may not do. Section 5 protects the title registered massage therapist, or RMT. Section 7 is setting up an advisory council under the Minnesota Board of Nursing, who voted unanimously at their December meeting to take on our advisory council. The registration qualifying criteria, all standard for Minnesota, including interstate endorsement or reciprocity, and a generous grandfathering clause, which would be annually renewed, is found in Section 8. There's an approval process for schools, grounds for discipline, which is the whole point of the bill, is in Section 12. Standard clause exempting RMTs from municipal ordinances is in Section 14. Fees, which are set very conservatively to fully fund the administration of the law over the first 5 years with no impact on the state's general fund, is found towards the end of the bill. It is also important to quickly point out Senate File 1233, as amended, does not fence anyone out of practicing legitimate massage therapy. Those who register with the state can use the protected title registered massage therapist. Those choosing not to register can still practice massage therapy, can still advertise that they do massage or massage therapy. They just can't use the protected title registered massage therapist. That's the difference. For practitioners who choose not to register from the day before this law takes effect to the day after, there will be zero change. The same is true for those practicing other forms of touch therapy. Reflexology, Rolfing, Traeger approach, Asian bodywork therapy, and many others are all exempted from having to hold this massage therapy credential, as well as those practicing currently under Statute 146A. We worked with the professional organizations who represent these fields to ensure no unintended negative consequences would come to their practitioners as a result of this law. Senators, please pass this bill, and massage therapy clients can know that the practitioner they choose has been vetted by Minnesota standard specific regulatory criteria. Pass this bill, and when a regulated professional does step out of bounds, there will be an effective means of holding him or her accountable. Pass this bill, and clients will see a dramatic increase in their access to care. I urge you to vote yes on Senate File 1233. I thank you again for the opportunity to come before you, and I'll cut the rest of my testimony short. I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee? And you have about, Senator Kubel, you have about three witnesses in support. Yeah. Question, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Kubel or your witness can answer. I'm looking at Section 14 of the bill, the effect on municipal ordinances, and just want some clarification. It says that the license authority provisions of some sections of this bill preempt the licensure and regulation of local municipal authorities. Does that include people who are massage therapists who fail to register? Does that include does the fact that they're a person is a massage therapist but chooses not to register, do they also have then their are municipal authorities also not allowed to regulate them as a result of that? I guess related to that, subdivision 3 of that section talks about prosecuting authority. It says that first that an unregistered person who practices massage therapy can be prosecuted, whereas if you're registered, you cannot be prosecuted for massage therapy unless you're engaged in unlawful conduct. And I just want some clarifications. It seems to me that would say that, I guess I'm not clear on what we're saying here. In the first part of it, are we saying that everybody's covered who's a massage therapist, even if they don't register? And secondly, if they don't register, why are they then subject to being prosecuted for doing massage therapy? But a registered person can only be prosecuted if they do something unlawful.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, the Section 14, the preemption of the local licensing ordinances for massage therapists, only apply to those massage therapists who are registered with the state. So if a massage therapist chooses to become a registered massage therapist, they would no longer have to have the massage licensing from the city. Now, section or subdivision 2 and 3 of that section has nothing to do with massage licensing. It has to do with general ordinances and violations of other municipal statutes, just making it clear that massage therapists, whether they're registered or not, are still liable to the municipality's other ordinances, and making it clear that the municipality can still require a general business license if it's required of other businesses in that city. So if let's say Brooklyn Center decides that they want to have an ordinance that regulates plumbers and accountants and contractors and massage therapists, any business that operates in the city, massage therapists, whether they're registered or not, would still have to have that license. But it's the specific massage licensing that this Section 14 Subdivision 1 preempts a registered massage therapist from. To answer your first question, for those massage therapists who choose not to register with the state, they would still be liable for those city licensing ordinance, massage licensing ordinances as well. So that's part of the decision that a massage therapist has to make, is if they choose to register with the state, they would be getting out of those city massage licensing ordinances. If they choose not to register with the state, they would still be liable to those city licensing ordinances.
Mr. Chairman, maybe council can comment here. I'm just looking at the language in Section 14, Subdivision 1. It seems to me to be, if the intent is to only cover people who choose to be registered, I would think that the language in that subdivision would have to be a little more specific. It seems to me to say that the provisions in the bill preempt the ability of any municipality to regulate.
This charge's name.
I guess maybe not. I'm just looking for some advice.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I can also offer you that the Minnesota Council of Health Boards, we worked with them to draft this language, and they have a representative here to be able to speak to that as well.
Okay.
We worked with them to try to make sure that this works for them and provides an incentive for massage therapists to sign on for the state credential.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, first of all, Senator Hahn, when you speak next to your microphone, we can't hear you.
Sorry.
Mr. Miller, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's almost like saying that the massage therapist can choose to be licensed by the city or licensed by the state. And that's, in effect, what you're saying in this bill, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, the massage therapists currently are regulated by a patchwork of city ordinances. Some
yes,
cities have it, some cities don't. And if they want to go into a city where there is a licensing ordinance in place currently, they have to abide by whatever that city's ordinance is. So if they choose to go into, if they have a client that calls them to go into Wayzata, they have to pay $8,300 to try and get that city's license. If they go to Minneapolis where there's no city ordinance, they don't have to do anything. They can just go in and do their business. If they go into Brooklyn Center, that's $3,500. So right now, they're choosing either to practice outside of the law or pay these, in many cases, outrageous licensing fees. And so by a massage therapist voluntarily registering, which is this is what this bill is for, is a voluntary credential, if they voluntarily sign on for it, they would be able to travel anywhere in the state that a client calls them to be able to provide that care.
Then, Mr. Chair, Miller, did I say that right?
Yes.
I did. So then what are you preempting? A preemption means that you're taking over the city's role in licensing, if I understand what preemption is. So what you're in effect doing isn't really preempting, because you already said that they could do, if they didn't want to license with the state, they could continue to license with the city. So it's going around like this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I'm sorry for the confusion. A massage therapist who becomes registered with the state would no longer have to register or license with any municipal cities that have a licensing ordinance in place for massage therapists.
Would not have to or may not. I'm asking, Mr. Chair, is are you taking away the city's right to license with this?
We're removing the burden from the cities of having to license like I said, we have one of the League of Minnesota Cities representatives here to testify. The cities don't want to be regulating massage therapists. They feel like they have to. to try to protect their citizens. But they don't feel equipped because it's an economy to steal. They don't feel equipped to be regulating this health profession, at the local level.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair, then Subdivision 2 isn't quite right. If what you're actually doing is preempting the city's, I forget what you called it, choice to license, then Subdivision 2, which said the provisions don't prohibit a municipality from requiring a license. So,
well, Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, if you continue reading that Subdivision 2, it talks about that it doesn't prohibit cities from requiring a license if the city requires a business license from all other professions, the same business license from all other professions.
A general business license.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
Correct. And that's
not what that says, though.
Well,
it says a license.
Well, further down, it talks about transact business within the jurisdiction of the municipality if the license or permit is required of other persons, regardless of occupation or profession. So Subdivision 1 is only targeting those city ordinances that are specific to massage practice.
Mr. Chair, I still don't think it's written right.
Mr. Miller, a question, why you would prohibit the cities from requiring criminal background in checks if they want to do that, since I don't think your bill does that. Why are you saying we don't want you to be able to do a background check on somebody? Am I reading that wrong? Because it looks like it says the provisions preempt licensure of a registered massage therapist, including without limitation conducting criminal background check. And if this bill is not requiring it, and now you're telling the cities they cannot require it, aren't you just leaving people in there without any background check?
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe that comes from the Board of Nursing that had agreed to be the oversight, and Mr. Vanasek can answer that question, I'm sure.
Mr. Chair, would you like to repeat the question real quick?
Why you are preempting cities from conducting criminal background checks when the bill is not requiring them for these? In other words, if I chose to be a registered massage therapist, I don't need a criminal background check to become registered, and you're prohibiting the cities from conducting them. Why is it you? I don't get the logic of that.
Was testified, right now Minnesota, the profession of massage therapy is regulated city by city with no reciprocity. Some cities licensed massage therapists, some do. Those that license massage therapists, some require background checks, some require letters from a doctor, stating you have no venereal disease. Some require letters of recommendation to the moral fortitude of the massage therapist. The problem is that there is no enforceable credential that if I'm a massage therapist, and it happened in Eden Prairie last spring, who committed a criminal sexual assault and raped a client on a massage table. Once there, and he was convicted, once he is out 8 years and has served his probation of not being able to practice massage therapy for 8 years, he could go to a city without an ordinance and practice. There's, in this case,
I understand, but why do you want to ban the cities? Supposing Minneapolis is very concerned about this and they want to do a background check, you're saying you can't do a background check anymore for a registered therapist.
In this case, we have a credential, a registered massage therapist, which you'd be able to, one, in the application, you have to fill out, you have to state that you have not done, been convicted of any felony, you've never stepped outside of your, not just conduct of care, but if you've engaged in conduct, if you look at Article or Section 12, Number 4, if you've been on the front end, but also on the back end, if you've ever engaged in conduct with a client that is sexual or may be reasonably interpreted by the client as sexual, or in any verbal behavior that is seductive or sexually demeaning to a client, or engaging in sexual exploitation of a client without regard to who initiates the behaviors, we would have, there's on record you'd have a state board that tracks these things and could revoke the credential. So
I understand that, but it just seems strange that if say the city of Minneapolis, and I don't know what cities have what, but why, if supposing Minneapolis does background checks, you're in effect saying if you register, then if you do something bad, you could be disciplined. But Minneapolis might say, well, we want to do background checks on these folks anyway, and you're saying we can't do that here.
Senator Marty, if I could respond to that. Right now, massage therapists are out there practicing who have criminal backgrounds, and there are many more, hopefully, that don't have criminal backgrounds. We did have, in the original bill that was working its way through the House, we did have a provision in there that would have required a background check of applicants. But when we looked at the other state statutes here in Minnesota that credential health care providers, there were hardly any that had a background check provision. Most saliently, the Board of Nursing does not require a background check of their practitioners. It's our understanding they're looking to bring one of those, amendment to their statute. But and with our board, our advisory council going under their board, we didn't feel it was right for our practitioners to have to meet a higher standard with a voluntary registration. The nurses have to meet with a mandatory license. So the provision was taken out. It would be our preference to keep it in there, and if the committee would like to amend it to keep the background check requirement in there, it would, we would certainly support
it
that.
It just seems strange to me that if Minneapolis wants to license, if they want to conduct background checks on massage therapists, you're going to say you cannot do it if they're registered, but you can conduct a background check if they're not registered, even though you're not doing a background check in order to become registered. So in other words, if I've got a criminal record and I want to do massage therapy, I'm not saying people think this way, but if they do, they could say the way to get around the background check is to get a registration, and then I can practice, then I don't need the background check.
Senator Marty, the intention here is to make it so that massage therapists are only regulated by one body. If they choose to sign on for a volunteer registration, they'd be registering under the Board of Nursing officially and would then be preempted from having to worry about this patchwork of city licensing. For those who choose not to register, and it's a business decision that they can choose to make, if they choose not to register, that's fine. They can keep practicing. God bless them. I hope they do well. But if they choose not to register, they would be liable to those city ordinances. And if that includes a background check, then that includes a background check.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Miller, so you're really not getting around, you're having a dual registration or licensure process. I don't think that your stated goal is being met.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prentner-Solon, the intention of the bill is to put in place a statewide standard credential that clients will be able to look to tell that a massage therapist has been vetted. If there are massage therapists who choose not to do that, who choose not to sign on for the state credential, they would be choosing, they're part of that educated choice of theirs as a business person, would be, if they choose not to register, they would be liable to the city ordinances. But there's not, it's either one or the other. The massage therapist would be registered by the state, or they would be licensed by the cities that require that.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Miller, I don't know of any other practice where you could either be registered or not registered, or licensed or not licensed. I mean,
well, Mr. Chair, Senator Prentner-Solon, there are several voluntary credentials here in Minnesota. The athletic trainers, up until a year or so ago, the physician's assistants had a voluntary credential. Respiratory care practitioners just changed to a mandatory respiratory therapist license, but before that they had a voluntary credential. It's not an unusual thing. Statute 214 in the Minnesota statutes puts in place a voluntary credential that enacts title protection as one of the means of regulating professions and protecting the public. And if there was no point in doing that, there wouldn't be no need for that subdivision in Section 214 or Statute 214.
Mr. Chair, I still would favor something that would require everybody to be registered. They're independent practitioners. I realize some of them may at times practice in a hospital setting or under some supervision, but for the most part, they're independent practitioners, and I think they should have to have a background check, and I think they should have to be registered.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prentice-Shalon, I would agree. Personally, it would be my preference to have a mandatory credential in place. And, in fact, we brought a bill last year, original 1233, Senate File 1233, that we just did the delete all amendment from, would have enacted a mandatory credential. But we got feedback from several legislators, both in the Senate and in the other body, that said that they were not willing to take a profession from essentially ground zero of no regulation to full mandatory licensing in one step. So we've come back now with this amended 1233 with what legislators have told us that they're more willing to discuss and more willing to put in place. All we're trying to do is put in place the most regulation that this legislature has told us that they're willing to discuss.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Miller, why do people not want to be registered? And what are the groups? Are they just some of the massage therapists, or are they?
Senator Prentice-Shalon, we have about four witnesses who wish to testify with concerns about their opposition to the bill. So they will. I think we should keep moving with the witnesses because we have two more proponents and four in opposition. They may answer some of those questions, like the city one, too. Ms. Finn and Mr. Sawyer, Dr. Sawyer. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'll tell you that I've been representing the League of Minnesota Cities for almost 10 years now, and I haven't been before this committee before. And the reason for that is because we don't really get into the business as city officials of trying to regulate health professions. I will tell you that we have a position in support of this legislation. I'm probably not going to make the folks at this table very happy, but we would probably be more comfortable if the cities were not preempted from conducting criminal background checks. That was something that was taken out in the Delete All Amendment, and that's something, some authority that we probably would prefer to retain. Otherwise, we do think that this legislation goes a long way toward helping the local units of government and the consumers understand what they're getting when they go in to see a massage therapist. And with that, I will stand for any questions you have and let you know that we appreciate Senator Cooley bringing this legislation forward. Thank you.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Finn, can you tell us how many cities in Minnesota have currently licensing provisions for this activity?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, we don't know. We don't actually have any way of getting that information from our folks. What we have heard through our policy development process is that cities tend to put ordinances in place when they're not sure what to do. When they get a request for a license or someone wanting to open up shop, they call the league and they ask, you know, what should we be doing? And we can give them advice. We can show them ordinances that have come to us from other localities, but we don't have an actual number. We do know that they're different everywhere you go.
And Mr. Chairman and Ms. Finn, I guess I'm familiar with that. I know I do work in the Education Committee, and we have associations that represent school boards, and they do things like model policies. I'm assuming that you do the same thing. My question is, has there been any effort on the part of the cities to develop a policy that would be consistent across municipalities or allow for one of the critiques of the proponents has been that there's not a transferable element to the current regimen? Have those things been discussed by cities, and why have there not been efforts to try to create that kind of a mechanism?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, a few years back, the massage therapist actually brought us I believe it was a model policy that we made available to our members, and it wasn't instantly adopted by, you know, we don't have any control over whether folks adopt those ordinances or not. And some, I think, that already had some in place opted not to look at it. Others who didn't have any concerns about businesses coming in also probably opted not to look at it.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Ms. Finn, if it sounds like there was not, on the part of the cities, a desire to have a uniform scheme of regulation for this. And so if that's the case, then why would we want to put this in place if there is apparently very little desire currently among cities to have a uniform mode of regulation, even to the extent of having a model policy? I'm a little confused about the purpose for this. It doesn't seem to be driven by desire of cities, since they had an opportunity to create uniform policies and they declined to do so.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, I think the answer to that question is that if folks had things in place, they left them there. And it is expensive to rewrite ordinances, and so they do it when they need to do it. And for some, they look at them every 10 or so years and have their attorney come in and kind of look at things and look at what's stale in there. And it's possible that some have, in fact, adopted the other streamlined ordinance, and others haven't had a reason to look at it yet.
Ms. Finn, I wonder if the league sends out, like if you sent out an email to the cities, I mean, I think they probably, most of them would tell you, yes, we have an ordinance. Now, could you send out, it's too late for today's hearing, but I wonder if you could send out a thing. I'd be curious how many cities do regulate, how many cities do background checks for this. I'd be interested, and I think other committee members would. If you can, I mean, just send out an email. I don't know how many respond to those, but I picture a good number would, and you'd get a sense at least. But
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to.
Thank you. Further questions? Dr. Sawyer, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Charles Sawyer, and I'm the Senior Vice President and former Provost at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. I'm also here today in support of Senate File 1233, which will create a statewide mechanism for voluntary registration of massage therapists under the Board of Nursing. In our view, it's long overdue, very much in the public interest, and it will be budget neutral. Northwestern is a regionally accredited educational and research institution that prepares massage therapists and other providers to enter the healthcare delivery system. We support this legislation not because it's the ideal or perfect bill or that the public is at grave risk without it, but a needed, logical, and evolutionary step for a rapidly growing health profession. Most compelling arguments for statewide regulation, in our view, rest with the qualifications, the expertise, and the value of massage therapists as members of a healthcare profession. In a 2009 survey conducted by the American Massage Therapy Association, consumers responded reporting seeking help from a massage therapist as often for medical reasons as for relaxation or stress reduction. Two other reasons that I would argue are health related. Another example, federally funded clinical trial research at our institution involving the care of patients with acute and chronic low back pain also includes massage therapists on an integrated care team, along with doctors of chiropractic, medical physicians, and other providers. In other words, a health profession, health professionals who are the only ones that are not regulated by a state licensing board, a regulatory agency. As you've already heard, the profession is currently regulated through this patchwork of individual city business ordinances, and I, as I understand it, primarily business ordinances. Or not at all in the case of the city of Minneapolis. As a result, the fees vary from location to location, and therapists having offices in more than one city often pay multiple business registration fees. It's an unnecessary burden that this legislation will eliminate. More importantly, however, this bill will provide a uniform mechanism for the submission and investigation of consumer complaints, especially if related to professional incompetence or sexual assault. In other words, they would go to one agency, the Minnesota Board of Nursing, a board that is accustomed to and has considerable expertise and history investigating complaints brought about by patients and clients of healthcare professionals. The scope of practice language in this bill is very intentionally accommodates the various ways in which massage therapy is practiced. And the grandfathering language will be equally accommodating to the very large number of experienced and skilled massage therapists currently in practice. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate File 1233 will establish a very broad statutory description of the practice of massage therapy and a statewide regulatory mechanism under an existing health board, both attributes deserving of a legitimate healthcare profession. Finally, and particularly now, with the demise of the Minnesota Department of Health Office of Unlicensed Complementary and Alternative Health Practice, this legislation is an example of the kind of sound public policy that should be and can be easily enacted. I appreciate the opportunity to address you today about this bill.
Thank you, Dr. Sawyer. Questions from the committee? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kubley, and to your witness, I do have a number of questions on the section of the bill that talks about registration by grandfathering. It's on page 7. I direct your attention to 7.21, and I'm trying to follow this, and I'm going to ask for a little bit of help. meet the requirements for registration in sub 1, clauses 1, 2, C1 and 2. I'm not finding 3. I was trying to figure out who's grandfathered in and who's not. And I'm not seeing the references on 7 that are called on at 7:21.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vanessa.
On the grandfathering, if you meet any of the II, III, or number 4, you'll be grandfathered in by either one of the following qualifications, either having completed a course of at least 500 hours, and most courses of study are 600, 650, 750, passing an entry-level massage competency exam, which is given in 7 different locations around the entire state of Minnesota, 5 days a week. Employment records of being a massage therapist for the last 2 years, or having active membership in a professional organization for at least 2 years prior, established by a letter from those associations, which to be a member you'd have to meet some of the above requirements.
Mr. Chair, if I could, then can you very specifically direct us on the references on 7:21 and 7:22? I'm not seeing where those specific references are made and included in this bill, is the point that I'm trying to work through. I see clause 1. I see clause 2.
Clause 12, yeah.
This should have been, it should be and.
It should be.
3 was taken out.
Maybe council could take a look at that and we could continue the discussion.
It appears there's a number 3 when there is no number 3.
So I'm trying to understand who's eligible to be grandfathered and who's not, and I'm thinking that it's not very clear.
It's a technical thing. I think we have to figure out what that's supposed to mean, what they want it to mean, and what it does. Yeah. I agree.
Well, Mr. Chair, yeah, I would say that that's far more than technical.
Well, right. I'm just saying it's the numbers there can't be right because there is no number 12.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, this is 12. Okay, it's the other 12. Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some questions along that same line. Who's going to decide as far as people who are grandfathered in? I mean, some of these people I'm sure have been working in the profession for quite a few years, and who decides what is an appropriate test for them to take, that shows that they're qualified. And my understanding is a lot of these folks got their education from a variety of backgrounds or different sources, different ways to come to what they're doing, and now we're trying to make it some sort of uniform system. And who decides that? What's the procedure there?
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator, as far as the board, it's up to the board to approve the competency exams, but there's 2 different widely used competency exams, again, that are given in 7 different locations around the entire state, 5 days a week. For folks who, many of which have been practicing for 5, 10, 20 years, if you just show that for the last 2 years you've been, and you haven't done, any one of the other items, if you just can show in some, either through tax return forms or just your business records, showing that you've been practicing massage therapy, you're eligible. It's a pretty low bar for grandfather.
Mr. Chair? Two other questions, Dr. Sawyer. How many schools are there in Minnesota that actually teach massage therapy?
Well, over 20. I don't have the exact number in my head.
Okay. And on that point, if I could, Mr. Chair, on Section 9 is line 823. I'm curious to know, it says for renewal you need to do 12 hours of approved continuing education, Section 148.9881, and I haven't been able to find where that 9881 is. I see it go from 9888 to 9882, and I don't see a section in there as well. Could you,
Mr. Chair and Sarah Dahl, actually, there's 38 schools in the state that teach massage therapy, 37 which are actually are accredited. But the continuing education, there were some of the opponents you'll hear from were concerned about, you know, that kind of adding on to costs for a massage therapist who's going under this. And that this is being brought forward by schools in order to be a revenue maker. We've just deleted the continuing education. Council took that out, and I did find the same reference you found, but unfortunately we weren't able to do that cleanup on that language prior to today.
So Mr. Chair, so you're saying that in this delete all that you're going to amend that out, that section out, the continuing ed is going to be amended out of
Correct.
There? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might make one more comment. There's a lot of language in this bill. Much of it's process or procedural. When it really comes down to it, the intent and the language of the statute as I read it will bring massage therapists who volunteer and would like to be registered by the Board of Nursing to bring them away from as many as 300 regulatory boards, in other words, local business ordinances, where the fees vary, the ability of those municipalities to actually provide oversight to a health professional vary dramatically, bring all of that into and under the Board of Nursing. Generous grandfathering, a requirement to only meet one of the following requirements, either education at a level of 500 hours or more, or simply being in practice for, frankly, a very brief period of time. That's an intentionally low bar that is mainly designed to accommodate the primary aim, and that's to bring all of these different practices under different municipalities under one single health board.
Mr. Chairman.
Two more questions, and I think we'll go with the opposition testimony. Senator Hand and then Senator Berglund.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Sawyer, I understand from your testimony that there is a financial advantage to people who are massage therapists to be able to avoid having to deal with multiple municipalities, although it's unclear to me how many municipalities have these regulations. And the board, the person from the League of Cities was not able to even tell us how many, so I don't know what we're talking about here. But I can understand there would be a financial advantage to the people who would fall under the jurisdiction of this action to do that. But I also, from talking to people, there are others who claim there would be a financial disadvantage to them by having to comply with this regimen. And so what I'm struggling with here is if the only purpose of this is to provide a financial advantage to one group of practitioners of a particular thing, why are we doing this? Shouldn't this be done if there is some public harm potential or avoidance of that public harm? And I've not heard any testimony at all on that. And I'm just wondering if you or others would like to comment about that in terms of why we should do this other than just to be of help to a certain group of a profession financially.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, as I testified to earlier, the Minnesota Council of Health Boards did do an extensive review of not just the business side of massage therapy, but also the potential for public harm and physical harm. And they came back and found that there was significant risk to the public from massage therapy being unregulated. And I believe you have that report of the Council of Health Boards in your documents. The Council of Health Boards is, as I said, a panel of not just healthcare providers themselves, but they're also healthcare regulators who have experience in looking at what risks there are to the public and what remedies there would be from regulation. And they came back and said that massage therapy does need to be regulated to protect the public. They actually came in their report, they actually said that a voluntary credential doesn't go far enough. And as I said earlier, we would agree with that. But we're trying to put in place the most protection that we possibly can for the public that the legislature has told us that they're willing to discuss.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Miller, just to follow that up, yes, I did find that, and I was reading through this. And it notes on page 4 that unlike some other health-related practices, examinations are not performed, diagnoses are not offered, nor is prognosis given. In the chapter or the section on safety and efficacy, it does say that that there are some potentials for harm.
But Sir Hand, where was that? Oh, your page 4, you said?
On page 4 at the bottom in the description of the occupation, it talks about how this is unlike other health-related practices in that there are not examinations, diagnoses, or prognosis offered. But then on page 5, it talks about the safety. It does mention that physical consequences of incompetent, improperly trained, or unethical practitioners includes harm. But in the recommendation, it says the legislature may wish to request and review available evidence of cases of physical, financial, emotional, and sexual harm. I have not seen or heard much evidence of that. I've heard it testified that it could be, and I agree that anytime you're dealing with people involving other humans and physically coming in contact with them, there's potential for harm. But to what extent and to what amount and whether it rises to the level of requiring there to be a regimen of regulation, I think that we should have some testimony, as the document suggests we should have.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, yes. And Sir Hand, thank you very much for the question, and I think this is why we're here today. In your packet, you should have a handout from us. The first page is Senate File 1233 with a letter from Mr. Miller, and then some documentation that shares with you some of the things you just shared in the Council of Health Board 2009 report on the first page. But then the second and third pages in states where we see complaints, and some states just track total number of complaints, but in Texas they break them down by program. And in Texas, the largest number of violations relating to massage therapists isn't sexual misconduct, isn't unprofessional conduct, isn't things relating to criminal history, but it's a failure to provide a standard of care. And that's, if you flip over to the last sheet, further documented, there's folks that slip and fall on a premise, some general complaints, I don't like my massage therapist, sexual misconduct, again, but actual physical harm, treatment injury, per occurrence can cause, if a massage therapist is working on someone's shoulder for 9 months and they have perhaps a torn rotator cuff, after 5 weeks, that pain should have, if it was tension, should have been taken care of. But if that was, if it went on for 9 months, that's not tension. There's an underlying medical condition causing that, and that can cause harm and damage by taking that.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Vanoska, I appreciate that, and I have looked at that. This is data for over a period of 8 years, where it says there were 67 instances of this around the country. How many of those were in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not aware of how many are in Minnesota. Just point you to that the average occurrence cost is $18,000. And again, back to the where Texas breaks it down.
I understand, Mr. Chairman, and the percentages don't have numbers, so I don't know what 71% of whatever number that was. But what I'm trying to get at is, if over 8 years there were 67 instances, and I don't know how many opportunities there were for clients to be seen by massage therapists. I'm sure it's been hundreds of thousands. and across the country over 8 years there were 67. I'm not trying to minimize those, but what I'm trying to get at is you're asking us to impose a regulation on the state of Minnesota for to avoid harm, and I'm trying to gauge what level of harm we're trying to prevent here. And I'm not clear from this that there is a high level of harm that would be any more significant than some other kind of profession that currently is unregulated. I don't know, and that's what I'm trying to get at. It's just not clear to me here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, if I could just respond real quickly to that. As I testified to you earlier, the Pew Commission found that while there's not a significant number of cases of harm for massage therapy, they found that massage therapy is appropriate for regulation by title protection, by voluntary title protection, as this bill would enact, to address those cases where it does happen. They found that it doesn't rise to the level of mandatory licensing, but that a title protection that is voluntary would protect the public by giving them a practitioner that they know, number one, has been vetted by standard criteria, and number two, they know that if something does happen and does go wrong, that there is a means of redress and a means of enforceable action that can be taken if something does go wrong. Currently, right now in Minnesota, there is nothing to protect clients. Minnesota Statute 146A, the office that administers that, was unallotted, and if a client were to call to lodge a complaint against a CAM practitioner with the office that's supposed to be administering 146A, they get an outgoing message where there's no means for the client to leave a message to have that followed up on. So, and the message directs the client to contact the police in the locality where the offense happened. Clients could do that, without 146A in place. They could contact the police, and I would argue should. But what this bill would do would enact an ordinance or would enact a regulation by which clients would have an enforceable means of protection, through this title protection.
So on Senator Hand's thing, I want to get this clear, there were 67 injuries were nationwide over 8 years.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at this.
I'm looking at the same chart. I was
right.
I thought that was one state. I didn't realize it was nationwide.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding. This is the American Massage Therapy Association, and it doesn't say it's for a particular state.
Mr. Chair, the data that you have there is from one organization that represents professional massage therapists. There is another organization that the same data is not factored into. This is just one organization that a benefit of membership includes malpractice insurance, and so that is the data from their malpractice insurance carrier for just their members. So it would not include members of the other profession.
Nonetheless, 58,000 massage cases over 8 years, clients. I was surprised at the low number overall, which is a good thing for the people performing the massages, suggests they're doing some good work. But Senator Berglund had a question, and I know we got to get to the opponents as well.
Mr. Chairman, my question has to do with the statement that was made that the provision that requires 12 contact hours approved continuing education every 2 years was removed from the bill, and I'm looking at the delete everything amendment, and it appears as if that language is on line 8.22 and 8.23, and so I'm kind of mystified about the testimony that it had been removed from the bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator, this section containing the continuing education requirements was removed from the delete everything amendment. However, there are, I believe it's four references scattered about the bill that we identified over the weekend but weren't able to incorporate into the delete everything at this time. So this bill has a couple more committees to go through. We'd have a cleanup amendment to take care of those pieces in the next committee.
Senator Lynch, and then the opposition testimony.
Mr. Chair, I think I'd be happy to hear from the additional testifiers, but I could go through, I've already noted at least five or more references and sections in the bill that I think need additional work, and we're the Health Policy Committee.
Why don't we take the opposition testimony and then talk. Welcome to the committee. We'll start with, well, whoever wants to start. Diane Miller, Greg Schmidt, Barbara York, and Carrie Johnson Pilava. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Miller?
Thank you, Senator, Chairman, and committee members. My name is Diane Miller. I'm an attorney. I'm the National Director of Law and Public Policy for National Health Freedom Coalition. We work with 30 states on safe harbor exemption bills. I also am here representing the Legal Reform Project for Minnesota for Natural Health. And today I was asked to testify just to give and I oppose this bill. I strongly oppose this bill. Our organization nationally opposes this bill, and so does the Minnesota Legal Reform Project. I was very involved in the passage, the drafting, the lobbying for Minnesota 146A, and that's the unlicensed complementary and alternative health care bill here. We successfully passed that bill with going through, I think, 14 committees. And I think it does a great job at dealing with this issue. And I noticed that none of the proponents really mentioned Minnesota 146A and the power of that bill, that law in Minnesota. And we're nationally known for that law. It's working very well. And even if the office is unfunded, the statutory power of that bill is that there are 27 areas of prohibited conduct for anyone that does a healing act, whether it's massage, homeopathy, whatever it is. And also there's mandatory disclosures and mandatory placement in your business place for disclosures of your business, 18 paragraphs of disclosures, and prohibitions against such sexual conduct as well. This Minnesota 146A has been working very well, and I think that the department can testify in terms of the number of complaints they've had, the number of disciplines that they've made. I believe, and I could be mistaken, there were 5 massage therapists in the last 2 years that were disciplined, or 4. But you can verify that with them. In our estimation, there's no need for massage registration for licensing bill in the state of Minnesota. The issues that this bill purports to address are already being addressed. They could also be addressed by short amendments regarding municipalities. There's a discussion about the municipalities that's going on, and I think it's interesting that the attorneys and representatives for the thousands of alternative health care people that touch the body have not been incorporated into the language of this bill properly. Let's talk about the city ordinances. This bill would prohibit people that have a registration from any municipal law. However, the Minnesota 146A people would not be preempted out of the municipality laws. And if there was going to be any change, you would think that you would go to the cities and you'd say, you know what, we have this really great law that's in place in Minnesota. Why don't you just adopt these standards and do a background check on all your people if you want to? But instead, they're developing a whole new bill. And in this bill, they've taken the language out of Minnesota 146A, and they've got sections, large sections in it that say prohibited conduct. And they've got large sections in it saying what they can do to a person. This is, a lot of it is already Minnesota law that works really well. The other thing it says is that the practice of massage therapy by a registered massage therapist includes all of these things. Well, you know what? Everybody does these things, not just registered massage therapists. There's people that are in the complementary and alternative health community that develop integrative practices that actually mix a lot of modalities together. And once you start, if there's no harm and the state is not registering a group of people because they're harmful and they're doing something scary like surgery, and they're trying to build a box of something that's not harmful, that's like building a box around a behavior like when we had the discussions with Minnesota 146A. A grandmother giving chicken soup would have been the practice of medicine. And in here, the state of Florida massage board shut down Reiki healers. You can't practice Reiki anymore in Florida because of the massage board. The Rolfers were shut down by the massage board in Iowa. They just made a law in the state of Texas that you can't touch the human body without a massage license, unless you're another licensed massage therapist. So we've got a national push. The thing that these massage boards did not know about when they made their licensing laws was they didn't know about Minnesota 146A. And now all these states are going forward trying to get safe harbor bills because it's a much easier way to regulate the non-harmful professions. It's a brilliant idea. You have a safe harbor exemption, and if you go out of that safe harbor, you get shut down with a cease and desist order. It's just very simple. It's simplistic. And you post everything in your business place. And you have 27 areas of prohibited conduct that the Attorney General can shut you down for. Whether the Department of Health is there or not, they're still going to be able to shut you down. So this is catching on across the country in the complementary and alternative health care community. There are 8 states now that have passed safe harbor exemptions. And there are 30 states that are considering it. So we as a leader in Minnesota have developed a solution to this problem that works really well. And we honor it. And it doesn't just work for massage therapy. It works for homeopaths, for Qigong healers, for Reiki healers, for naturopaths, traditional naturopaths, for herbalists. And since it's working really well, I don't think that a group should go forward and get an exclusive registration when there's a whole bunch of other complementary and alternative healthcare practices. So the concept that I want you to really think about and that I'm really concerned about is why does the state regulate a profession? And I respect Senator's questions about what are we doing here? We have lots of really urgent things to do in the state to regulate. And the criteria in Minnesota for regulation is if a profession is harmful, then we protect the public. But we figured out a safe harbor exemption that gives these guidelines that are very particular and gives the state a quick way to act. Instead of saying, are you practicing medicine without a license, you say, are you doing one of the prohibited conducts, 27 paragraphs? Did you give out your disclosure? That seems to be a great example of government's best way to regulate without a lot of overregulation. So I'm very excited about that model of legislation that you passed, and I'm protective of it, and I appreciate it. And I'm proud of it. I'm proud of it across the country. I speak in many state capitals explaining to attorneys about Minnesota 146A. And there's many attorneys. Even the Attorney General of New Mexico stood up and explained their safe harbor bill last month and passed a safe harbor bill there. So we're in the face of being in a state where there isn't massage regulation already because we passed Minnesota 146A first. Well, that was a good idea. So now to come afterwards and pass it doesn't make sense to me. So thank you so much for your...
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Questions from the committee? If not, Barbara York?
Catherine Berg is going to go first and explain.
Okay. Catherine, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Berg. I am not a massage therapist. I am the vice president of the Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project, which is a consumer and practitioner group. And just a little bit of my background, just so you know, because it becomes a little relevant later. I am a graduate of the University of Minnesota in Morris and Purdue University, but also worked in admissions for the University of Minnesota for many years. The provision of the bill that I'm talking about is Section 10. And what this is, it talks about which education is going to qualify for the registration. Now, we all know that they have grandfathered everybody in, right? And so we can assume, however, that there are going to be some people who do not choose to get that grandfathering. For example, the League of Minnesota Cities and the Minnesota Department of Health have both said that cities may very well require, and they certainly are free to require, this registration process. In some cities, that will save money. In some cities, it will not save money for the practitioner. Some cities, it's $20 to get your license. The city of Wayzata, for example, does have this $59.50 cost, but that's only if you haven't been to school. And if you've been to school to be a massage therapist, it costs you nothing to go to Wayzata and set up a massage therapy practice. And so this might actually be more expensive for them. But what we want to talk about in particular is which schools can be licensed or can be registered. The bill says that they have to teach a program of at least 500 contact hours of combined massage therapy, be licensed by the Minnesota Office of Higher Education or equivalent agency, and be accredited by an agency recognized by the United States Secretary of Education for accrediting. Now, in your packet that's got a clip on it, and there's a bunch of colored sheets of paper together, mine is a bright yellow sheet, and you don't have to look at it right now, but it lists the seven institutions that qualify. And these seven institutions are generally accredited so that their students can be eligible for financial aid dollars, federal dollars in student aid. While certainly there are standards at these schools, the accreditation is more to prove legitimacy and some consistency in what's being taught, okay? So we need to be clear about that. And the accreditation process is very lengthy, very expensive, and very onerous. Thousands and thousands of dollars, months and months of time. They have conferences they have to go to, and all for a low-credential profession, as the author in the house described in massage therapy. So how this affects Minnesotans, and this, by the way, is the biggest objection to the bill by the American Body Workers and Massage Professionals, which is another massage therapy group. So the other thing you should know is that only 43% of all massage therapy schools in the United States are accredited. This apparently isn't a common thing in the massage therapy industry. And so that would be 676 of the country's 1,575 approved massage therapy schools are accredited by one of these seven agencies. All right, so it's apparently not a big deal to not be accredited by them. And since only 43% of all schools nationally are accredited, chances are more likely than not that if a massage therapist moves to Minnesota after the grandfathering period, he or she would be unable to practice in Minnesota, especially if they wanted to move to a city that decided they were going to require this registration. And remember, this group has readily admitted they're moving on to requiring a licensure at some point, okay? So let's look at closely what's going to happen in what schools are accredited in Minnesota already. COMTA is one of the groups, and this is came from the American Massage Therapy Association, one of the proponents of this bill, and it is the only national organization for massage therapists who are pushing this bill. And when you look in the federal government's list of accrediting agencies, they do not consider COMTA a healthcare accrediting agency. They actually consider it a personal care and services group, and they have lumped it in with the cosmetologists. Okay, there are two that I could find, two organizations, massage schools in Minnesota that are accredited by COMTA, and it is Northwestern Health Sciences University and CenterPoint. Okay. Yeah. There's three schools that are accredited by ACICS, which is one of the other ones on the list, and that is Duluth Business University, Globe University, and Minnesota School of Business. And then finally, we have Everest Institute, which is accredited by the ACCSC. Now, we don't know how many massage therapy schools there are. They just said 38. In their documentation earlier, they said more than 45. So, and I don't know if that's the number of campuses or what it is. So who is not covered? I think that's a really important question, because once this grandfathering period goes by, it's possible that some of these people are going to have a really hard time getting a job or finding a place to work. Most of them are private, but the biggest category, counting to 24 schools, are the massage therapy schools, which are part of the MNSCU system. In 2007, the most recent year for which numbers are available, according to the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, 750 students received degrees or certificates in massage therapy at the 24 campuses. There are actually more than that enrolled, because it is a two-year program in some campuses. And this amounts to 7% of the students at the 24 campuses. And they estimated that $1.4 million of state grant funds were given to those students. If this bill passes and the cities decide that they're going to enforce it, which we've had testimony, as I will remind you, from both the Minnesota League of Cities and the Health Department over in the House, that it probably will be required by a lot of cities, the graduates of the MNSCU campuses will be unable to work in those cities. The MNSCU campuses are accredited by the Higher Learning Commission, which is part of the North Central Accreditation, but it isn't one of the seven organizations approved by the U.S. Department of Education that they list in this bill. Other schools that are not would not be eligible, you guys recognize her? This is Sister Rosalind Geoffrey. Her schools also would not be eligible. Her graduates of her schools would also not be eligible. And she was the pioneer massage therapist in Minnesota. She was arrested by the Vice Squad in St. Paul for opening up a massage therapy clinic in 1983. And so I think that if this bill were to pass, her graduates also would not be eligible for this registration, which, by the way, might become required. So I would urge you to vote no on this bill, because it's in total conflict with the goals of the Minnesota Department of Higher Education. Their graduates would not be eligible for this. And I'm happy to answer any questions, or I will turn it over to Barbara York.
Thank you, Ms. Bird. Questions from the committee? Go ahead, then. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Barbara York. I'm the president of the Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Network. I have been coming before you for several years now. I started looking at the whole issue of regulation for massage therapists in 1987, when at that time we worked with the practitioners who were presidents of different state organizations. None of us were owners of schools. We looked at the 214 and realized that this did not apply to us. Since that time, there were very few schools at that time and very low-houred, because our education is by hours, not by college credits. But that for all the people who were undereducated, according to this legislation, there is no proof of harm. And there is no actual physical proof of harm. You have boundary issues, which is common in all professions, regulated or not. The 146A nicely addressed that. It was something that practitioners were looking for. The Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Organization is run by and for practitioners, and we're not affiliated with any school or insurance group. We've been supporting and protecting the practice of massage, touch therapy, and somatic education since 1981. We're the oldest state organization in Minnesota. Our board members are volunteers, and we do not have paid lobbyists. The MTMN has been a proponent of good regulation. The MTMN helped pass important pieces such as the 146A and the amendment to Chapter 609. Both are consumer protection laws and supported by consumers and practitioners. The 146A has allowed practitioners of many modalities to practice without creating any turf wars. It was passed with support. There was no opposition, as you are finding with this bill. So people who are Reiki, Shiatsu, Rosen body workers, neuromuscular practitioners, connective tissue practitioners, you don't have to figure out if they're in or out. With the 146A, they're in. As a massage therapist, maybe not. So what we also passed was the 609, which raised the penalty for any massage therapist who are sexual predators. They must register as a felon and a sexual offender because of that bill. The MTMN testified in favor of the amendment before the Crimes Victims Subcommittee. Karen Long of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, which is a voice for victims, survivors, sexual assault programs, and allies committed to ending sexual violence, stated that she had contacted one of our national organizations who said, oh, we can't support that, and received a reply stating that they could only have a neutral stance. We proactively gave you more teeth with the 609 than any licensure bill in the country, let alone what's presented to you today, has ever been able to do. Only now has the Chiropractors Board adopted the 609, which means you do anything sexual, a sexual assault, you are convicted of a felony, you will register, which is a wonderful way for the cities to check on their sexual, you know, predators. You have to register as a sex offender in the state of Minnesota as well as any place in the country. We were there. This was about the consumer.
Mr. Chairman.
Though this is claimed as a voluntary registration, the cities will make this mandatory. At the licensing subcommittee, we heard from the author in the House and from the Minnesota Department of Health that this would become mandatory. So this is not something that's going to only affect a few. It's going to affect many who don't even know sometimes what's going on, because I'll tell you, the practitioners were not contacted with this. There are many organizations who received no notice of the hearings this last summer. We are not invited to the table because our voice has too much opposition for those who would like to see this pass through.
Mr. Chairman?
The ABMP...
Are you, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Are you close to, I'm actually going to, I just don't feel, in talking to some of the other members, that we're, this bill is not ready, and we're going to, I guess I'm going to move to lay it over. Yep. And work out some of the details, Mr. Chairman. So I would move to lay this on the table.
That's non-debatable,
yeah.
Senator Coring moves the bill to move it later on the table.
Lay it on the table, and then, you know, I'd be more than happy for my good friend Senator Kubley to pull it off the table whenever that he has some of these things worked out, because I for one, don't feel comfortable. Obviously, I'm a co-author on this bill, but it needs some more work, so.
On Senator Coring's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion adopted. Motion carries. Sorry, I've got the wrong word. So, yes, you can talk with the author and work with him and so on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you,
Committee. Senator Lori, you have witnessed from out of town in your bill?
It's open.
Out of town. Okay. Is Senator Latz in the room? If so, we'll take Senator Latz quickly first, and we may get to, depending on how fast his bill is, we may get to yours yet.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Spock. Yes, you.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out, not that it's necessarily anything's going to happen, but according to Rule 12.5, we're not allowed to meet while the Senate's in session, and the Senate goes in session at 2:30.
Skeleton crew.
And Mr. Chair, I understand there's this thing called a skeleton crew that
we will race.
And in my mind, I think I'm not a big fan of that because I think it's a little goofy. But I just wanted to point that out so that I'm on the record pointing it out.
Okay, we will try and finish before they go into session because I know how fast they go into session usually. Senator Latz, welcome to the Health, Housing, Family Security Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill that you have before you, Senate File 2877, arose because of what was either a miscommunication or some misinformation relating to licensure requirements when there was a new licensing category called licensed professional counselors implemented. In Minnesota, And as it turned out, at least one person who qualified within that category, and we believe more, did not get all of the continuing education credits lined up at the proper time, and as a result was not renewed. There was some confusion, perhaps, in connection with the language that was used with regard to the timing of when those continuing education credits needed to be completed. This matter was already heard in the House, and the bill was that you have in front of you as originally drafted was more broadly drafted to remedy the situation for everyone who was in this position. But in the House, the author, Representative Simon, and the licensing board, I understand, came to an agreement to deal with the individual situation that brought this matter to our attention, and I have Ms. Garwick Foley here with me as well. Because in part because we can't get other information under data practices law, in part because we just don't have any specific information about its broader application. But the sense of the House committee and what I would suggest to the committee here is that there was at least an inequity involved in this situation that we have the opportunity to correct. And to accomplish that, we have the A1 amendment. This would be considered an author's amendment. This is my first and, I believe, only committee in this matter.
Senator Torres-Ray moves the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Would you like to explain real briefly the situation that brought you into this? And by the way, does this cover others? You're saying, you said you're trying to limit to fixing. You're not trying to limit to fixing this. You're not doing the broader thing. You're just trying to address. You know this will address her situation. It may affect others. We don't know because of data practices.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, although we are fairly confident this will solve this situation.
Right. You want to give a one-minute summary of why what happened?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A brief summary.
Basically, I was licensed in 2004, November 2004, as a licensed professional counselor. And at that time, the statutes and rules required that I complete, that everybody who applied complete an additional 12 graduate-level credits within a two-year period, and then after that, 20 hours every year of continuing education. Excuse me. This was to be able to comply with the National Board of Certified Counselors so that the license would actually be reciprocal. You could travel with it throughout the United States.
Can you pull your microphone closer so we can hear you?
Oh, is that better? Thank you. In 2005, then, changes were made to the rules that would allow a prorated CEU system so that if you didn't have to get all 12 credits, graduate credits, you would get your 12 credits or however many you needed, and then so many CEUs within the next 2 years. They then changed the rules again to give you 4 years to complete the 12 credits in lieu of the CEUs. And when that was all passed and made law, large packets were sent out to everybody who was licensed to be able to see what the changes in the law were and what the effects were of the law and so forth. Then in 2006, the rules were changed again. And the rules basically, they added in addition to the 12 extra credits during the first 4 years, you had to get the CEUs. However, they didn't publicize that. And it wasn't posted in the
State Registry
until 2007, which by that time I was already 3 years into my license. I had 1 year left. But I was reading the statutes, and the statute says thereafter, it still says thereafter the first 4 years, then you start accumulating your CEUs. So clearly there's conflict between the wording in the statutes and in the rules. The statute says you have 4 years to complete your 12 credits, and thereafter you start amassing CEUs. By rule standards, which were not posted until 2007, it says in addition to the 12 credits, you have to get the CEUs. That's something that I wasn't informed about, and indeed the people who counsel the graduate students who are going to be applying for LPC didn't know about it either. So even my alma mater was still, up until last November, was counseling their students that they needed to get the 12 credits in 4 years' time and then get the CEUs after that. So basically, after getting the additional 12 graduate credits and applying for renewal, my renewal was rejected as being incomplete, and my license was terminated then last February.
So now with this, with the others who have been getting misinformation from the schools, have the schools changed? The schools are now accurately reporting what you need to do when?
My alma mater is.
I hope others are. I hope the board is. Does the board have any opposition to this? Is there anybody in the audience who has any opposition to this? So committee members, Senator Berglund.
I would move that Senate File 2877 as amended be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Senator Latz, have you spoken with the board, or has the testifier spoken with the board? Have they registered some concern about this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Prettner-Solon, my colleague in the House has been doing most of the legwork on this, Representative Simon. I spoke with him, and I can relate to you what information I have from him, which is that apparently there was an unusual drop in the number of licenses that were renewed after this timeline took place. And so there, at least one conclusion from that would be that there were a number of people that failed to meet the credit continuing education requirements that would account for the drop. There apparently has been an ALJ reviewing this matter also, who concluded that the word thereafter in the statute could be read to include the in addition language that's in the rule, and therefore there was not a conflict. But the board is certainly apprised that this is an issue. This has been kind of an ongoing dispute. They came forward in the House to oppose the original draft of the bill, which was more broadly drafted. But they agreed that it could go forward at least to remedy this particular situation. I believe that the information is out there that would support a conclusion that there are more people that were affected by this than we specifically know about. Because of data practices protections, we can't access that information directly. And the board has not specifically contacted me. They've been working directly with Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, I'm always reluctant to pass legislation that would bypass the board. And if there are a number of other people who have been affected, then it doesn't seem fair to allow legislation that would allow one person to go ahead and live under different rules than another. I just feel like we need more information and the board needs to be involved at some level.
Is the board here today? Not obvious. Yeah, I'm wondering if that's a sign they don't care or they're aware of the hearing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Prettner-Solon, the board was involved, I know, in the discussions with Representative Simon directly in the House. And I'm informed that what you have before you as the EA1 amendment is a result of their agreement.
So it is an agreement as far as you know?
Yes, there is. And also, I think they were at least comfortable with this because there was some dispute about whether certain information was included in the packet that was sent out to Ms. Garwick-Foley relating to the information she needed to have to know what to do.
And this
so we're comfortable remedying this situation in this way. I'm reluctant in the same way that you are to be dealing with this on a one individual basis, but it seems to be the only way the board was comfortable allowing this matter to go forward, and they aren't giving in information regarding others that might have been affected.
Senator
I made the motion.
Senator Berglund made the motion that Senate File 2877 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Oh.
You got to speak
I did
fast.
No.
Okay, you did. I heard the no. I just after I'll try and slow down a little.
Thank you.
Well, I think we might be in violation of the Senate rules. That's why I wanted to move it.
Yes. Do we know if they're meeting yet?
I don't have it on my thing. I can pull
it
up.
Should we start Senator Lori's bill, and if they're meeting, we'll have to... That way you can have your witnesses testify.
What?
They're checking, so why don't you start presenting, and we will not vote on it if they're meeting.
Oh, I would be...
Senator Fischbach is planning to go up and join the skeleton crew.
Mr. Chair, they might be on Senate time, though.
That's what I'm kind of thinking. They'll probably start in half an hour. But we'll be done well before then. Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've got Senate File 2815 to present, and I will give you a broad overview of the bill. In the 2008 health care reforms, one of the major pieces actually was collecting a large volume of encounter and claims data to help improve the quality of cost and quality of providers across Minnesota. And I want to first state by saying that this bill is understands that, and everybody involved in this bill is very committed to these cost and quality improvements that are anticipated to result from the collection and dissemination of this very valuable information. To step through it real quickly, this was brought to me by provider groups and the Minnesota Medical Association. To step through the bill, it's largely about timelines for dissemination of this information, but it also adds some quality improvement program language in Section 2, and it repeals a section regarding an elimination of the bottom 10% of providers after the peer grouping gets started. So to the first part, the timelines.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Senator. You have a delete all amendment. Do you want to?
Yes, I have a delete all authors amendment to offer first. It'd be the A1
amendment. Senator moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape he wants. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Both the bill as introduced and with the delete all still meets the broad overview that I just gave. So now, specifically to what is in front of us with the A1 amendment. Thank you again, Senator Higgins. We'll go through the timelines as they were in the 2008 legislation and the proposed timelines. There is a sheet in your packet that kind of outlines this that really does do a pretty good job of explaining what this bill does. First, health plans and third-party administrators were to submit claims beginning July 1st, 2009. This bill doesn't change that. That did happen. And the claims analysis and encounter data is going quite well. It is not quite on timeline, but we can cover that in a second. The next timeline in the legislation, as originally passed, was recommendations on a uniform methodology for peer grouping developed. That was due January of this year, January 1st. This bill does not change that. The third timeline was when the results of the first analysis of this information would be disseminated to providers. The initial legislation called for a June 2010 rollout to providers, and actually that has been slowed down a little bit, even in the contracting that the Minnesota Department of Health has done for the analysis of this. We're unable to make that initial deadline. And this bill and our current contract through the Department of Health would call for an October of 2010 rollout to the provider community. The initial bill provided providers the opportunity to review the data and the results for accuracy and get back to the MDH about any possible errors or concerns, and it gave them only 21 days to file any of these concerns regarding a very large and complicated volume of data that is going to be new for people to look at and digest. And 21 days just really seemed like a very short timeline to digest, again, this very large volume of information. This bill moves that to a 90-day timeline for review. Peer grouping results publicly reported is one of the issues addressed in this bill. The initial 2008 reforms called for a September 1st, 2010 rollout. This delays that for 1 year, September 1st, 2011, rollout to the public. Peer grouping information and methodologies used by CGIP, political subdivisions, and health plans was initially slated for a January 2011 rollout. That also is postponed by 1 year to January of 2012. That's really what happens with the timelines, and again, it's to allow the provider community to take a look at this data, get used to it, and begin to try to implement some of these quality improvement issues on their own before rolling it out to the public, and have some time to be able to make sure that it all is what is intended. Section 2 of the bill is that quality improvement program. It makes sure that the provider community is able to use this very first run of data to do just that, improve their quality. And then the final section of this bill is a repeal of the prohibited, the bottom 10th percentile of providers on cost quality measures are prohibited from participation in Medicaid, GAMC, and Minnesota Care under the 2008 reforms, and this would repeal that. And I do have the president of the MMA here, Robert Meech, to discuss a little bit more detail some of the provisions in this bill.
Dr. Meech, welcome.
Senator Marty, members of the committee, Senator Lurie, thank you very much. I'm Bob Meeches. I'm a physician with a specialty in internal medicine and geriatrics, and I'm here today as the chief executive officer of the Minnesota Medical Association to urge you to support the Senate file 2815 before you. The MMA has been very involved with the provider peer grouping efforts. We've been working hard to inform and educate Minnesota physicians about the project, and we've had physicians representing our organization on multiple committees, including the advisory committee. We have been impressed with the work of the quality and the quantity of work that the Minnesota Department of Health has done to advance this project, and particularly given the extremely aggressive and, in our opinion, unrealistic timelines established by you folks in 2008. We think they've done a really good job moving this forward. However, the bill before you accomplishes three things, all of which were addressed by the advisory committee, which the department set up for peer grouping. First, as outlined by Senator Lurie, it strengthens the provider peer grouping project by adding an explicit quality improvement function. It modifies the timeline to not only reflect the current implementation plans from MDH, which have changed, but also to provide reasonable review and refinement of the methodology. And third, it repeals a punitive provision added in 2009 that would limit public program enrollees access to care by providing some by prohibiting some providers from participating in programs. Let me, if I can, just speak briefly to each of these three points. First, quality improvement. The research has shown repeatedly that quality improvement, giving data, tools, and resources directly to physicians and other providers, improves results. And yet that explicit quality improvement focus is absent in Minnesota provider peer grouping project. The all-payer database, which will be very helpful that the state's establishing, has the potential to be extremely powerful. The information being collected and aggregated related to cost and quality of clinics would be extremely useful data to physicians, clinics, and hospitals. It's data that we currently don't have. And although there is far less evidence that reporting this data publicly will generate any improvement or will be used consistently by consumers, we are not looking to limit that. We're not looking to limit public reporting by the physicians of Minnesota, but we believe quality improvement is where the real benefits can be realized. And we feel very strongly that a quality improvement program where physicians and other providers can review their data, understand it, develop an action plan, and improve their care is a critical element to be added to the project. And that's the first piece in this bill. Second, modification of the timelines. The timeline changes proposed in the bill reflect the revised implementation that is included in MDH's contract with their vendor, Mathematica. The changes also proposed are intended to reflect the complexity of this project. Let me see if I can explain that to you. This provider peer grouping project is envisioned to generate results for use by state, by health plans, and by other purchasers of care to tier providers or to develop incentives for patients to choose certain providers. It's high-stakes use information, a use for which most of the researchers would argue is very premature. This data could be used to limit patient choice, to shift patients from one clinic to another, to disrupt successful patient-physician relationships, and to damage physician, clinic, and hospital reputations. And as such, the credibility of these results, that is, the underlying data and the analytical methodology used to arrive at the conclusions, warrant accuracy. Well, are we looking for perfection? Of course not. The physicians of Minnesota are not looking for perfection, but we do submit that greater recognition of the relative infancy of some of the proposed methods for conducting this analysis is needed. The expected use of this data appears to exceed the capabilities of current measurement techniques to reliably differentiate one clinic's performance from the other. In fact, according to the Federal Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, the HRQ, in a study that they had conducted by the RAND Corporation, the researchers concluded, and I quote, that no healthcare efficiency measures, that is, cost measures, including the ones proposed by Mathematica, have published evidence of sufficient scientific soundness. That is, the RAND Corporation, working for the federal HRQ, says, we don't have the methodology to even do this very well. In addition to the cost measures, the quality measurements that are included in the peer grouping system are similarly complicated. One of the measures that will be created is a total care measure for clinics, and it's recommended that that's going to consist of 32 separate measures, all aggregated, all broad, but to give a picture of the clinic's performance. Well, the measures proposed and the relative rating or importance of the measures are critical to determine what happens, and yet these are just the opinions of an advisory committee. There's no guidebook. We've never done it before. We don't know what the right way is or the wrong way. The actual peer grouping results will reflect the opinions and best guesses, but the results would be different if we picked another 32 measures. How do we choose what's more important for the public? In other words, labeling a clinic or hospital as high quality, low quality, high cost, low cost is an expression of the levers that are turned on or off by the methodology. We believe we have to take the time to make sure that methodology works and is accurate before bringing it forward to the public. It could make things very dramatically different if we go one way or the other. And therefore, I believe the timeline changes that the Medical Association is seeking are relatively modest in light of the real methodological limitations and the new ground that we're really trying to forge in Minnesota. The bill would give Mathematica, the vendor for MDH, the necessary time to obtain the data, understand it, test it using various assumptions and options, and give us a clearer and reasonable period of time to validate the results and act on the results prior to reporting and use by payers. Finally, the third issue in the bill is limiting access. This bill would repeal a provision added in the law last year, 2009, that would prohibit physicians and other providers who fall below the 10th percentile on a combined measure of cost and quality for serving public program enrollees. The provision is extremely punitive. It's a very blunt tool by which to discern so-called high-quality, low-cost providers. And given the recent discussions, the payment rate barriers that many clinics and hospitals are confronting and will be confronting in the near future, we have significant concerns about further limiting patient access, this particular segment of patient access, to physicians and hospitals. And we'd urge you to support the repeal of the provision. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Dr. Meeches. Question, center hand.
Before we open up to questions, if I could just a couple of more opening issues. I don't mean to present that this is without controversy. There are those that believe, and I think the Minnesota Department of Health has shared some concerns, and I believe is planning on testifying regarding those concerns. And we are actively in conversation with them to see if we can come to some agreement about what ought to be done in regards to this. And we do share a joint goal of making sure that we do use this data appropriately to improve quality and cost measures of all providers across the state of Minnesota, and do believe that Minnesota citizens will benefit from that effort. And then one other just opening comment. I will say that, this is an area that I actually worked in private sector before coming to the legislature, and honestly, my biggest embarrassments The two that come to mind are when I rolled data out before it was ready. I worked on data like this, and there are two instances when I came forward and made statements about data that I was looking at that turned out not to be true. And it was really a painful process and set back a lot of the initiatives that I was using that data to try to further. I did get them back on track and did meet with some success on those, but it was a significant setback and a real problem for me personally. So with that, I see some members have questions.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Laurie, I guess I'd agree with you. I think this is fairly controversial. I, in the private sector, also worked for a while with the company I worked at with quality improvement, and I know that this is not something that is always objective, and there was some allusion to the fact that there are debates about the meaning of data and how it's interpreted and how you apply that against criteria and so forth. So I have an issue with the fact that this is going to be something that the commissioner or the department or some government agency is going to develop on behalf of every provider in the state. And I think that's a real problem. And I just recall a few years ago when we were developing standards for education, and we had some tests and we were going to apply those and we were going to measure and talk about schools and how they performed, and there was some debate about whether we should rate them with stars or some other language, and it got very controversial to the point that we don't do that anymore. And my point is that no matter what the standards are, even in something like public education that is a government enterprise, this was very controversial. And now we're talking about applying that kind of regimen to entities that are not government entities but are private entities. And so I'm very concerned about the direction that we're going to turn over to the department or the commissioner the ability to tell us what is quality and then have some, I'm assuming, some regimen to enforce that by calling out, well, here's a high quality, here's a low quality provider based on what the government has decided is quality. And I think that to me this is a big step toward the idea that government ought to be the final arbiter in telling the public about health care and what is good and what isn't. And I personally am not inclined to go there, but I see this as a step in the wrong direction.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I think you bring up some valid points. I think that the issue that you would have a bigger issue with the 2008 reforms that we did, I think this is actually kind of saying that we should take a step back and bring in some of the private interests to help government make sure that the data that we use is vetted through the private entities, with the private entities too, and that they're at the table as we look at what this is. Right now, this is rolling out, and this is happening. This is, you know, those horses left the gate already, and what this is saying is, you know, we should have a little bit more thorough review before it hits the public, give the providers a little bit more time to digest it themselves and make that initial round of quality improvements. So I think that this, you know, in that regard, I think this actually helps address some of your concerns that would have been and that were put forward when we were in the 2008 healthcare reform debates, and you stated them clearly at the time too. I know.
I'd like to have Senator Berglund's question. Then the commissioner's been very patient all this time. I'd like to have her testimony before we end today, even if we're not ready to act on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, that was my point. Commissioner Mangan's been sitting here for our entire meeting. I'd like to make sure she gets a chance to testify before the meeting is over.
So why don't we
maybe while she comes up to the table, then I would just have a comment to make to Senator Laurie and Dr. Meeches. And that is that when this was passed in 2008, 90% of the patients, physicians, were already in the community measurement project. And that is all made public today. Their quality outcomes, all made public today. So since 2008, the other physicians who have the other 10% of the patients have had every opportunity to join the community measurement project and have their information measured and made public, and they also then would have had an opportunity to dispute that data. Waiting until now and holding up the most major part of the cost containment measure that was passed in 2008, I think is irresponsible.
Dr. Meeches, very quickly.
May I respond, Senator Marty, Senator Berglund, committee? I think you're with no offense, misrepresenting the situation. You are correct in the facts you present. But this is a complex database of all payer data that the physicians have not seen, the hospitals, the Department of Health, no one has seen. And if we followed the approach that community measurement uses, we would delay the timelines even further than we are currently. I sit on the community measurement board, and community measurement vets this data, and it doesn't let any data out until it's been shared with the provider, shared with the hospitals, and everybody's in agreement that it's reasonable data to set out. So what's in the legislature is a very different process than what community measurement has.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Dr. Sandy Magnin, and I'm commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about provider peer grouping from the 2008 health reform legislation. At that time, when it was passed, it was a compromise for level three payment reform. It was agreed that this provider peer grouping would shine a light on value in the state of Minnesota, which was desperately needed. The department has been working diligently to implement the health reform, and with PPG, provider peer grouping, being a cornerstone of that legislation. We've laid the foundation with an encounter database, creating standardized quality rules, and last summer held 9 advisory meetings with stakeholders, including the MMA, on the methodology for PPG. I know there are ones who want to delay the release of these quality over cost rankings by a full year. I believe we do not have the luxury of time. Every day, healthcare costs continue to go up at an unsustainable rate. Let me point out several facts and operational points for PPG for you to consider. First, we now have a contract, a work plan, and a timeline to work with Mathematica Policy Research with subcontracts to Minnesota Community Measurement and the University of Minnesota to do this job well. We have bifurcated the release of the data such that total cost and quality would be released by January of 2011, and condition-specific quality and costs would be released by March of 2011 by the timeline. So, in fact, based on an actual work plan, we are delaying the release of the data. We are working with Senator Lurie as the bill's author to make it consistent with the Mathematica contract while still making the data available as soon as possible when it is scientifically sound. We're working with MMA and have shared suggested language to address the issues that have been raised. The work plan with Mathematica calls for meetings with providers, so providers will continue to help shape this process. Even beyond the scope of the contract, MDH recognizes the need to include providers and stakeholders in the continued refinement of PPG. Last summer's advisory group recommended that we continue to seek input, either through another advisory group or other means, to ensure that PPG evolves in a manner that provides value to the stakeholders, and MDH is exploring how best to accomplish that. Second, the advisory group last summer clearly identified the conditions of diabetes, CHF, coronary artery disease, asthma, total knee replacement, and pneumonia for condition-specific evaluation. All of these have either developed guidelines and or baskets of care. Providers have been working on quality improvement in these areas. For example, there are efforts already away for healthcare homes, the Diamond and High-Tech Diagnostic Imaging Project by ICSI, study and forum on BCAG, on provider best practices, work on prevention of hospital readmission. The list could just go on and on about quality improvement initiatives that providers have an opportunity to participate in right now. I've urged providers, including MMA members at their board meeting previously, to continue or to start working on quality improvement now. Third, public reporting in and of itself is a powerful quality improvement tool. Lacking this, providers will not be able to see each other's results, find best practices, or have engaging conversations in their own communities as well as with others. I understand providers' desires to have more time to see the data. But in essence, they already have the quality component if they're participating in current quality initiatives, and health plans have been giving providers feedback on their relative cost for years. I would juxtapropose providers' desires with the desires of businesses to know value information, the desire of policymakers to provide the greatest value for state health care programs when we have a $1 billion budget deficit, and the desire of patients who pay for health care out of pocket to know where to go for the greatest value. As a physician, as a scientist, as the Commissioner of Health, I'm committed to seeing that PPG is done well and not released before it is a good, solid, sound report. Last week, I personally met with Mathematica, OnPoint, Minnesota Community Measurement, and the U of M to discuss my expectations. Further delays will not be based on an arbitrary date, but based on a work plan and the needed time that we need for a reputable product to be released in Minnesota. We have been working with providers in this process, as has been noted, and by the advisory group, as well as we have phone calls weekly with MMA. We frequently attend their board meetings. I was there with Dr. Meeches this month at 8 a.m. on a Saturday to talk about provider peer grouping and healthcare homes and to listen to their concerns and suggestions. Although we might differ on the timing of the release of PPG, we've had good working relationships with MMA and other providers, and I thank them for their support and input. I know that good strategic thinking in government combines the facts with operations and political reality. I wanted to make certain that you had facts and operations about PPG, knowing that the legislature, the governor, and other policymakers will take into account all of these and the political reality in determining next steps. We at MDH will carry out your directives with integrity, collaboration, and accountability. Thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thanks for joining us today. You indicated that there's a work plan in place. So do the dates that appear in the A1 amendment, are they reflective of that work group? Or is it rather that the original dates that are have been changed are reflective of the work group, or?
The actual amendment does not reflect the work plan of Mathematica. As I said, we would actually be able to release, according to a work plan and a timeline, be able to release total cost and quality by January of 2011. The specific conditions, their total cost and quality, could be released, according to the timeline and the work plan, by March of 2011.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, isn't it true that until the information is released, most businesses won't have anything really to go by in terms of contracting with most cost-effective quality providers?
No, there's at this point in time, there is no statewide value information, quality over cost, that businesses or providers or community groups can engage in that conversation about how can we improve value.
That's right.
When Minnesota Community Measurement was created, that was many years ago, and we needed to go along at a different pace. But now we are in a place where we know a lot in Minnesota about how to do this work and how to work with providers and how to share information. And we will do that during this process, and we'll work carefully with Dr. Meeches and his constituents and to make certain that this is a sound product so that providers, employers, the state, and consumers can have this information to make wise decisions.
So, Mr. Chairman, my concern is that without, you know, if we're going to delay all this time making this information public, businesses and individuals will not then have information they need to begin bringing down their health care costs. And in the meantime, health care costs keep going up and up, and more people keep losing insurance, and more people have crummier insurance policies with more out-of-pocket costs. And we knew this was going to become law in 2008. Every provider in this state has had the opportunity to join quality improvement projects and certainly have their information vetted through that process since that time. And here we are, 2010, saying we're going to wait until 2012 to make something public. I don't think that's acceptable.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I wonder if you could comment a little bit about Section 4 of the bill, of the A1 amendment that's regarding the repealer. We've had a lot of conversation about the time frame. I wonder if you would provide some thoughts for our consideration on the repeal.
And then after the department's comments on that, I think we have to either decide we're going to act on it now or we're going to lay the bill over. We can take it up on, we can finish the bill on Wednesday, but I want to be respectful of time. We're already overdue. So let's do this, and if the committee wants to act now, fine. Otherwise, we can take it up first thing Wednesday.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Jim Golden from the Department of Health. Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I think some of the detailed questions around Section 4 and the repealer might be best directed to the Department of Human Services. This is within their responsibility. I guess what I would say with regard to Section 4 is in the governor's interstate sales bill, there is also a repealer of this. However, it is replaced with a tiering product program for public programs that would then allow the public programs to look more like the other entities that are required to use the data as well. So I guess that would be what I can say on that.
Does the committee want to spend more time on this on Wednesday, or would you like to deal
Mr.
with the bill
Chair,
now?
I think probably more time would be warranted. I do know that there are additional questions and would hate to
I don't want to cut
this.
It off prematurely.
This is about a discussion, and there are strong points on both sides, and we acknowledged that right at the beginning of the discussion. And I think that allowing folks to continue to work on this, and even if it passes this committee, the discussion will not be complete at that point. So
in that case, we'll just put this bill on. We'll lay it over till Wednesday. We'll put it on the agenda for Wednesday. And with that, we are not having a committee meeting tonight, but we are, I believe, going to have one on Wednesday night, unless we can get a miraculous number of bills done very quickly, which this committee is not always good at. Senator Dell.
Mr. Chair, are we supposed to wear green that night, too, then? Is there some green beer afterwards?
Yeah.
With that, this meeting is adjourned.
Bills up that night.
Yeah. Oh.